Good afternoon. Shabbat Shalom. Greetings from Sabbath. Greetings from the happiest place on earth, as they call it. And today we're even happier because we have an addition to the family, as a lot of you know. Gideon David Mosley. And a lot of you have already contacted us about it, and we appreciate the response that we've been getting. We haven't heard yet from our people in Kenya, but we expect we'll be hearing from them eventually, too. And so hello to those out there in Maroba and other areas in Kenya that may be hearing this eventually. And I hope to talk to you a week from today, if it works out. Maybe our first actual contact by, you know, audio, by phone, live audio contact in that way. We have a special guest with us today. We have Gideon's grandmother, Sonia, who's on her way to Washington, D.C. to take up her position as Deputy Secretary of Labor in the Obama administration. No, I'm kidding, but I've asked her to open with prayer, and we're going to do Psalm 121. So I'm going to give the mic now to Sonia for the opening prayer.
I lift up my eyes to the hills. From whence does my help come? My help comes from the Lord, who made heaven and earth. He will not let your foot be moved. He who keeps you will not slumber. Behold, he who keeps Israel will neither slumber nor sleep. The Lord is your keeper. The Lord is your shade on your right hand. The sun shall not smite you by day, nor the moon by night. The Lord will keep you from all evil. He will keep your life. The Lord will keep your going out and your coming in from this time forth and forevermore.
Amen. That was probably the New Revised Standard Version translation, so I know some of you are using various translations, you know, NKJV, Old KJV, NIV, whatever translation you're using. By the way, those sounds you heard in the background were not the baby in that case. But if you're all right. I wanted to talk today on a subject that I wanted to tie in with the events that we've been going through here. But I'm calling the talk a reminder to be overcomers. A reminder to be overcomers. There's a tendency among people to get kind of satisfied with the way we are and not to want to improve ourselves. But life is a challenge, and God wants to have a relationship with us, and he wants us to develop character. He wants us to be the kind of people with whom he can have a relationship, and that requires us to be in concert with him, working with him to improve, to become better people, to be more like him. To be more Christ-like in our own personality and character. You know, the Apostle Paul, in writing to the church in Philippi, if you want to go to the first, into the letter to the Philippians, he says to them, and I'm breaking into the middle of a thought. With the Apostle Paul, it's hard to know where to start reading from because, you know, you wind up reading the whole chapter to get to where you want to be. He had long sentences. But in Philippians 1:6, jumping into the thought, he's in Philippians 1:6, he says, being confident of this very thing, that he who has begun a good work in you will complete it until the day of Jesus Christ. So God is working with us, and he has a goal in mind. He wants us to be the kind of people with whom he can share eternity. And so he's working with us, and we are in effect a work in construction in that sense, a work in completion. You have that in mind, of course, when a new life enters the world. When I hold my grandson in my arms, I can't help feeling giddy. It's really quite an experience. even the child moaned it, grandchild moaned at that one. I give these groaners now and then. In Philippians 2, Paul was talking to them about the fact that he couldn't be in Philippi most of the time. you know, he could write them, but he couldn't really be there most of the time. We have a lot of people who listen to this program, to this these messages, and who live in Southern California, and we'll have the opportunity to be out there on March 7th for service out there, and a lot of you are aware of that. Actually, we've been a little bit surprised at the response. We originally were going to have it in Chatsworth, but actually we've decided we're going to have to reevaluate that and actually rent Dodger Stadium. No, but we do have a lot more people than we thought, so we are going to change the location. We're going to try to use a library in Simi Valley. The last time I spoke publicly in Southern California, they ran me out of town. No, but the last time I spoke there was back in the fall of 2003, and it was in that library in Simi Valley. A lot of you were there who listened to us, so we're going to try to go back to that location. But we'll let you know officially very soon, you know, the address of the location on March 7th, but we appreciate the response that we've had. Anyway, Paul was writing to the people in Philippi, and he says, therefore, my beloved, in verse 12 of chapter 2, he says in Philippians 2:12, he said, therefore, my beloved, as you have always obeyed, not as in my presence but only, but now how much more in my absence. Now that I'm not there, you know, you should even do better because I'm not around, you know, to sort of push you to do it. But much more in my absence, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. You know, have respect for your future, your potential, what God wants to do with you, and keep on that path, you know, keep improving, you know, for it is God, in verse 13, for it is God who works in you both to will and to do for his good pleasure. You know, he delights in you, he wants to have a relationship with you, and he's working with you. And Paul himself was concerned. You know, he wasn't just so self-assured that he couldn't stumble and make mistakes, and very serious ones if he you know, wouldn't be careful. Look what he says in 1 Corinthians 9. If you don't mind going back a few pages to 1 Corinthians 9 and verse 27, Paul says, in writing to the church at Corinth, in 1 Corinthians 9:27, he says, but I discipline my body and bring it into subjection, lest when I have preached to others, I myself should become disqualified. So he didn't think that, oh, I'm so good, I can't, you know, I can't do wrong, you know, I've got it made. No, he knew that he had to continue to exercise discipline and have character. You know, he's not some exception to the rule. You know, we all have our problems to overcome. And that's what I wanted to talk about today, to realize that each of us has strengths and weaknesses, and God works with us according to our strengths and weaknesses, and he patiently develops character in us. And, of course, each person is going to have to deal with differently, just as each child that we have has to be dealt with differently according to the strengths and weaknesses of the child. That's something I want to say more about in a moment. I'd like to go to Isaiah 64. Isaiah 64. This is a very beautiful analogy here in Isaiah 64 in verse 8. By the way, all of this is introduction. I haven't even gotten to the subject yet, but we'll get there. But now, O Eternal, Isaiah 64, 8, O Eternal, you are our Father. We are the clay, and you are our potter. And all we are the work of your hand. All of us are the work of your hand. So he's, you know, molding us and shaping us like a potter. You know, the clay is on the wheel and the potter is shaping it. And so that's how he's working with us. And so we have our strengths and our weaknesses, and he works with us accordingly. Some of us are probably too brash, too vain and self-assured, so we're going to be taken down a peg. Others of us are too timid, too reserved, and he has to kind of light a fire under us and get us to be more bold. So he'll deal with us accordingly. There's a proverb on that in the 22nd chapter of Proverbs, one that a lot of you know well, and it's been used in different ways, but this is one way to understand it. Now, see, Proverbs is a book that is written poetically, so each word is chosen poetically, so you draw more than one meaning out of a word in Proverbs. So if you go to the 22nd chapter of Proverbs, there's some beautiful poetry there. And, of course, a proverb is saying where you can get a lot out of a few words. So in Proverbs 22:6, it says, train up a child in the way he should go, Proverbs 22:6, train up a child in the way he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it. So it's obvious, there's an obvious meaning to work with children while they're young so that when they're adults, they're good adults. But if you focus on the words and dig in a little more, one of the ways to understand it, when it says train up a child in the way he should go, if you look at the original Hebrew, one of the meanings is train a child in his way. Train a child according to what's best for that child. Use the approach best for that child. You know, and when he is old, he won't depart from it, meaning the, you know, the way that you've been teaching him, he'll continue in the instructions. But train a child according to the best needs of, you know, according to the needs of the child. And so it's a very important principle. And I wanted to talk today about a particular individual who's a wonderful example in many ways, but yet he had his problems like we all do. He had faults to overcome, as we all do, but he did overcome a major one of his faults, which was he was a rather timid person, not a courageous person, and he had to overcome that. As I said, some of us are so conceited that we have to be humbled. Others of us, though, are so, we don't have enough self-esteem, and we have to kind of get a fire lit under us, and evidently that's the kind of person he was. And I'm talking about one of the great heroes of faith in the Bible, who's mentioned in Hebrews 11. I want to go there. Hebrews 11, which is what we call sometimes the Faith Hall of Fame. And in Hebrews 11, in verse 32, the author is just going on and on, talking about many historical characters that people who would have been his audience would have known right off. If he would have mentioned their names, you know, they would have known who he meant, you know, what they did. You know, he was talking to people who were quite knowledgeable of these things. So in this letter to the Hebrews, the author of this letter in this 32nd verse of chapter 11, he says, "And what more shall I say? For the time would fail me to tell of Gideon and Barak and Samson and Jephthah, also of David and Samuel and the prophets." Now I see here Gideon, David. Wonder if that somehow rings a bell. You know, but this child, this grandson of ours has really some pretty big shoes to fill here. But the point I wanted to make is that Gideon had to overcome the Midianites. You know, Gideon had to overcome Midian. So if we had a smidgen of the faith of Gideon, we could overcome our Midian. You don't know it, but I'm a poet. You know, so if we become Gideonites, we can overcome our own Midianites. You know, I want to talk a little bit about Gideon from that point of view. So since I made that comment about a smidgen of Gideon, the faith of Gideon, I'd like to go to Luke 17. Since we're in the New Testament, we can flip a few pages on the way back to the story of Gideon. Before we get there, I want to go to Luke 17 and verse 6. This, of course, is a statement that we all fall short of, but it's a guide or it's an inspiration to look to. This is Luke 17, 6. Here are Christ's words. "So the Lord said, if you have faith as a mustard seed, you can say to this mulberry tree, be pulled up by the roots and be planted in the sea, and it will obey you." If you had that kind of faith, you know, it's like that song that some of you know, "There can be miracles when you believe." If you had that kind of faith, you could actually do great things. And we need to have at least a little faith so that we can do great things. And how do you acquire faith? Well, that's what they asked here. And it's interesting how you acquire faith. And that's not my subject today, but in verse 10, just since we're in the middle of this thought, I thought I'd comment on verse 10 of Luke 17. It's a verse a lot of you know. If we do want to increase in faith, it means that we need to live a life in such a way that we don't just worry about, well, when have I crossed the line? But we want to, you know, actually, you might say, stop short, far short of that line when it comes to doing wrong, but maybe even go over the line when it comes to doing the right thing, being zealous for the right thing and being very careful not to do the wrong thing. Not that we are fanatical. That's wrong as well. And you don't want to be out of balance and fanatical. That's also wrong. But in Luke 17:10, I'm breaking into a thought, but he says, "So likewise you, when you have done all those things which you are commanded, say," this is in Luke 17:10. "So likewise you, when you have done all those things which you are commanded, say, we are unprofitable servants. We have done what was our duty to do." So what he says is go above and beyond. And if you go above and beyond, that increases your faith. So in other words, step out and do the right thing, or step away from the wrong thing and do so with zeal, and your faith increases. Well, I want to talk today, give some examples of the life of Gideon. As I said, this talk is a reminder to be overcomers. And as I said, Gideon had his strengths and weaknesses, and it seems that one of his weaknesses was that he was a little bit too much on the timid side. Let's go. Now, maybe in a way, you know, you could say that, well, I know so many obnoxious people, it's nice to have somebody who's more timid, but that can be a problem, too. I'd like to go to the book of Judges. And as I turn to the book of Judges, I'd like to ask you a question. If you were going to deliver a nation from oppression, who would you choose to do it? John Wayne or Don Knotts? And that's kind of the situation here. Jephthah was a kind of John Wayne figure. You can read about him in the 11th chapter of Judges. He is more of a swaggering cowboy, you know. But Gideon was more of the Don Knotts, you know, character, the shakiest gun in the West or whatever, if you've seen any of those movies. And yet he was the one that God chose to command a small army that overcame an oppressor in the middle of the 12th century B.C., the time of the Judges. So let's go back to the 6th chapter of Judges. Speaking about movies, you know, over the next couple of days, you'll be hearing a lot about movies if you keep up with the news. And I was thinking about Gideon Mosley, and if somebody were going to make a movie about his ancestry, it would be a very amazing movie. It would be a combination of Roots, Fiddler on the Roof, Dances with Wolves, and Gone with the Wind. And I'm telling you, you talk about a blockbuster. That would really be quite a movie. All right. Anyway, I want to get to Judges 6, and since I've taken so much time with the intro, I'll just summarize here that the Israelites are now under oppression. They're oppressed by the people of Midian and Amalek and others who are coming in and raiding them, taking away their food. And so they brought it on themselves because they had become corrupt. A corrupt nation is weak and vulnerable to this kind of thing. A corrupt nation is a vulnerable nation. The Israelites became corrupted, and the result was a punishment that came upon them. And so if you go to verse 8, I'll jump in there. This is Judges 6, 8. Again, to save time, I'll just say that God sent them a prophet. He's not named as such, but it says that a prophet came and told them, you brought this on yourselves. You know, you're crying to God now, but you've been sinning. Now you're crying for help, but still God heard them. You know, he told them why they were being punished, but then he in effect still delivered them. So he was merciful to them. So in verse 11, we have now God's direct intervention. First he tells them, okay, here's why you've got the trouble, and then he intervenes. And so in verse 11, there's a theophany, there's an appearance of God to a man who's not a great heroic figure. He's farming, a man named Gideon. In verse 11, now the angel of the Eternal came and sat under the terebinth tree, which was in Ophrah, which belonged to Joash the Abiezrite. While his son Gideon thrashed wheat in the winepress, he went to where you normally would have grapes, but he brought the wheat there because he was trying to, you know, keep out of sight from the Midianites. I mean, it was that bad. You had to thresh your wheat in secret, lest somebody come and take away your wheat. So I presume this is in late spring at the time of the wheat harvest, when he's doing this, maybe around the month of June on our calendar, on the secular calendar. So he threshed wheat in the winepress in order to hide it from the Midianites. So this is a theophany. At times in the Old Testament, God appeared in a form where you could actually have a conversation. He became a communicator of his own words. And John spoke about this in the first chapter of John. This is the Logos. This is the Word of God. So really, if you're a theologian and you want to use refined language, you would say this is the pre-incarnate Jesus Christ. This is the Word of God appearing to man in a form where you can have a conversation. And it's called in Hebrew, Malach Adonai, the angel or the messenger of the Eternal, or the angel of the Lord. And in verse 12, he appears to Gideon. And when God appears to a person, it's a traumatic thing. It's not a light matter. It's usually a very traumatic matter. So Gideon, as you'll see later, was traumatized by it, as we would expect. But it's interesting what happens here in verse 12. And the angel appeared to him and said to him, "The Eternal is with you, you mighty man of valor." You know, what are you talking about? He must have been really surprised. I mean, he wasn't a warrior. He was there hiding. He was threshing wheat in secret. And here God calls him a mighty man of valor. Well, in effect, he's telling him that's what you're going to be. That's what the potential is in you, if you'd have the faith. Gideon said to him, "Oh my Lord, if the Eternal is with us, why then has all this happened to us? And where are all these miracles which our fathers told us about, saying, 'Did not the Eternal bring us up from Egypt?' But now the Eternal has forsaken us and delivered us into the hands of the Midianites." Now, it's interesting that God didn't pounce on him for this comment. You know, he he realized that his people were suffering. He believed in God. He believed in what God had done before, and now he's questioning, why are you allowing this? Well, if he thought about it, he's allowing this because of, you know, how the people had become corrupted and so on, you know. But still, it's reasonable to ask questions like this when things happen, and God didn't just pounce on him for it. But God answered in this way. He said, "You're asking why haven't I intervened? I'm going to intervene. I'm going to use you." In verse 14, then the Eternal turned to him and said, "Go in this might of yours." And again, that's kind of an ironic statement, but in effect, I'm going to give you this power. "Go in this might of yours, and you shall save Israel from the hand of the Midianites. Have I not sent you?" So now he's telling Gideon, "All right, you're complaining about the situation. I'm going to solve the situation, and I'm going to use you." So he said to him, "Oh, my Lord, how can I save Israel? Indeed, my clan is the weakest in Manasseh." You know, he was from the tribe of Manasseh, and he was a prominent leader in Manasseh. He said, "My clan is the weakest in Manasseh, and I am the least in my father's house." That was his estimation of himself. And the Eternal said to him, "Surely I will be with you, and you shall defeat the Midianites as one man." You know, God was going to do this in an unusual way, so to increase people's faith, to show them the power that was behind them. So he deliberately chose a man who was not a warrior, chose a small group of people who were not professional warriors in order to win this victory, because he was making a point. Then he said to him, "If now I have found favor in your sight, then show me a sign that it is you who talk with me." Now, I would imagine that already he had some sense that this was a special a person talking to him. But nevertheless, he required more assurance. And you'll see this is constantly the way he is. He always seems to just ask for one more sign, one more indication that everything is going to work out. As I said, he doesn't seem to be this brash, risk-taking kind of person. Seems to be a very cautious kind of a person. And so God, as I said, works with us and brings out the best in us. In verse 18, he says, "Do not depart from here, I pray, until I come to you and bring you my offering and set it before you." And he said, "I will wait until you come back." So isn't this amazing? Here God appears to him, and he says, "I want to go bring something." So he says, "All right, I'll wait for you." It's kind of interesting. So Gideon went in and prepared a young goat and unleavened bread. He's in a hurry. And, you're not going to wait around. In those days, it would have taken time for the bread to rise the way they prepared it. So it was unleavened bread from an ephah of flour. The meat he put in a basket, and he put the broth in a pot, and he brought them out to him under the terebinth tree and presented them. So it was kind of oak tree, and he brings the offering. The angel of God said to him, "Take the meat and the unleavened bread and lay them on the rock and pour out the broth." And he did so. Then the angel of the Eternal put out the end of the staff that was in his hand and touched the meat and the unleavened bread, and fire rose out of the rock and consumed the meat and the unleavened bread. So that's a sign. You want a sign? All right, I'll give you a sign. So he does that and then disappears. Well, that's again, is the second sign. You know, and the angel of the Eternal departed out of his sight. So now Gideon has a sense, yes, this has been a theophany. This has been, you know, God has appeared to me. So now Gideon perceived that he was the angel of the Eternal. So Gideon said, "Alas, O Lord Eternal, for I have seen the angel of the Eternal face to face." This is not something that at all is normal, you know, and he feared, of the repercussions for such a thing. Then the Eternal said to him, "Peace be with you. Do not fear. You shall not die." You know, shalom, peace. You know, so Gideon built an altar there to the Eternal and called it, you know, in biblical times, it would have been Yahweh Shalom, or in modern Hebrew, Adonai Shalom, the Eternal is peace. To this day, it is still in Ophrah of the Ebiezrites. So when this account was written, that altar was still there. So it was a testimony to this event. It was still in existence probably at the time of Samuel when this account was prepared. They could still go and see this altar. Now it came to pass the same night that the Eternal said to him, see, now he has a challenge. He's going to have to do something very bold. That's what I'm saying. God is in effect preparing him to be his agent, and he's getting him to do things he normally wouldn't do. "You take your father's young bull, the second bull of 7 years old, and tear down the altar of Baal." You know, that Israel had sunk it into idolatry. With all that implies, you know, the idolatrous worship involved a lot of hideous practices. And a lifestyle that went with it. And they were worshiping Baal, and right there, you know, in his area. and tear down the altar of Baal that your father has and cut down the wooden image that is beside it. Now, this is the kind of thing that could get you killed. And build an altar to the Eternal, your God, on top of this rock in the proper arrangement, and take the second bull and offer a burnt sacrifice with the wood of the image with which you shall cut, down. So he wants him to sacrifice to God and to even use some of the remains of the other altar that he cut down. So that's a very radical step to take, but it's the beginning of a reformation of the country. If the country is going to be saved, the country has to, you know, get back to its faith. So in verse 27, so Gideon took 10 men. I think that's interesting in itself. God didn't tell him, gather a group of people and do it. He just told him to do it. But he's the kind of person that needs to have a group there. And so he took a quorum, you know, a minyan in the Hebrew, you know. He took a 10 men, a minyan, a quorum. So Gideon took 10 men from among his servants and did as the Eternal said to him. But because he feared his father's household and the men of the city too much to do it by day, he did it by night. So he was bold, all right, but at the same time, he was bold in a cautious way. He did it at night, where he wouldn't be seen immediately. You know, so he did what he had to do, but in the most cautious way possible. It's interesting. But still, he did it. And when the men of the city arose early in the morning, there was the altar of Baal torn down, and the wooden image that was beside it was cut down, and the second bull was being offered on the altar which had been built. So they said to one another, "Who has done this thing?" And when they had inquired and asked, they said, "Gideon, the son of Joash, has done this thing." Then the men of the city said to Joash, "Bring out your son that he may die." So you see, it was a very risky thing that he did. So you have to admire the courage, even though he did it with 10 people in at night still. It was a courageous thing to do. "Bring out your son that he may die, because he has torn down the altar of Baal, and because he has cut down the wooden image that was beside it." But Joash said to all who stood against him, "Would you plead for Baal?" So he gave him a good answer. He said, if this is a god, you don't have to worry about it. He'll deal with Gideon. You know, if you're so worried about it, if he's a god, just back away and let him act. "Would you plead for Baal? Would you save him? Let the one who would plead for him be put to death by morning." You know, who do you think you are sticking up for God? Let alone. "If he is a god, let him plead for himself, because his altar has been torn down." So, in effect, what's happening here is the people are being, in one sense, weaned away from their idolatry. It's part of the process of reforming the nation. "Therefore, on that day, he called him Yerubbaal." He called him the name Baal. May Baal contend. You know, Baal will contend, meaning Baal will strive, Baal will fight. Because you're the one that knocked down his altar. So Gideon now has a new name, Jerubbaal. Baal will contend. So he becomes, you know, Gideon the iconoclast, Gideon the idol smasher, you know, which is really a great title to have, an idol smasher. You know, he killed the right kind of sacred cow that needed to be killed. "Therefore, on that day, he called him Jerubbaal, saying, 'Let Baal plead against him, because he has torn down his altar.'" So he took the first step in bringing his people back to their God and in leading them to liberation. Now we have the battle, which I won't really cover that much of, because it's a story a lot of you are familiar with. And what I wanted to talk more about was Gideon the man rather than the actual amazing battle that takes place. But I want to say a little more. I'm not finished yet. So in verse 33, "Then all the Midianites and Amalekites, the people of the east, gathered together, and they crossed over and encamped in the valley of Jezreel." This is an area where troops gather traditionally. And as I said, it was probably in the spring of the year when you have these major engagements, because at that time it's not raining in the land, nor is it really, really hot. So unfortunately, a good climate for war. So that's when you have a lot of your wars in the Middle East, is in the spring. "But the Spirit of the Eternal came upon Gideon." So now he has done his part, so God is doing his part. And so now he has extra inspiration. "But the Spirit of the Eternal came upon Gideon." So he blew the shofar. He blew the trumpet, right? Shofar, so good. "But the Spirit of the Eternal came upon Gideon, and he blew the trumpet. And the Ebezrites gathered behind him." All right, so the people of Manasseh gathered behind him, and now he's getting also more people involved. Now, see, that's the mistake he's making in a way. He said, "Well, if I'm going to win this battle, I've got to have this huge army with me." That would be normal, but that's not what God's going to do. You know, he's going to have a small army deliberately to make a point, you know, that you can win with a small army. But anyway, at first he gathers this army together. Verse 35, "And he sent messengers throughout all Manasseh, who also gathered behind him. He also sent messengers to Asher, Zebulun, and Naphtali. These are other tribes in the northern part of the nation. And they came up to meet them. So now you think after all this, now we're ready. No, he wanted another sign. You see, it's just interesting. He wanted another sign after all that's happened. I mean, he was able to get rid of this idol. He didn't die. Now he's got people gathering to him to fight the Midianites. He's got God's promise. He needs another sign. And you think that God would say to him, what do you mean you need another sign? What a pain in the neck you're turning out to be. No, he actually gave him another sign. So Gideon said to God, if you will save Israel by my hand, as you have said, look, I shall put a fleece of wool on the threshing floor. If there is dew on the fleece only, and it is dry on the ground, then I shall know that you will save Israel by my hand, as you have said. So that's an interesting sign that he came up with. It reminded me of a movie I saw where somebody wanted a sign, and so in this movie, God allowed it to rain in his car only. Everybody else is driving along, and in his car it's raining, if you've seen the movie. But, you know, it's a biblical example here. And it was so, when he rose early the next morning and squeezed the fleece together, he wrung the dew out of the fleece, a bowl full of water. So the dry was ground, but the fleece was soaked. Well, he's got his sign. No, he wants another sign. All right? Then Gideon said to God, do not be angry with me, but let me speak just once more. Let me test, I pray, just once more with the fleece. Let it now be dry only on the fleece, but on all the ground let there be dew. Now, that's the time of year when people pray for dew in the Middle East because they're not getting rain. So that's when they want the dew to be there. And God did so that night. It was dry on the fleece only, but there was dew on all the ground. So now he's ready. Now he's got his signs. But you know what? God gave me even another sign. He encouraged him even more. So as I said, he works with you as he needs to work with you. And in this case, he gave him even another sign, as you'll see. To save some time here, let's say that God told him, you have too many people. I want you to actually winnow out, you know, the army. Make, you know, anybody who has any doubts about it, let them go home. And which is a biblical principle from Deuteronomy. But then even beyond that, he had another test in verse 4. But the Eternal said to Gideon, the people are still too many. Bring them down to the water, and I will test them for you there. This is verse 4. Then it will be that of whom I say to you, this one shall go with you, the same shall go with you. And of whomever I say this one shall not go with you, the same shall not go. So God is continuing to work with him in this special way. And that's, of course, very reassuring, just to have this contact going, this communication going. That's very inspiring. So he brought the people down to the water, and the Eternal said to Gideon, everyone who laps from the water with his tongue as a dog laps, you shall set apart by himself. Likewise, everyone who gets down on his knees to drink. And the number of those who lapped, putting their hand to their mouth, was 300 men. Now, I would think a normal person, when he comes to a body of water, is going to get on his knees and cup his hands and drink. You know, I think that would be a normal way to do it. And that way, too, you're more alert. You can kind of be looking around and, you know, get right up if there's something happening. But some people, I guess, just plunge, you know, themselves into the water. They either get down on their stomach or on their hands and feet and just, you know, stick their face in the water like a dog would drink. And I would think that would be a minority because they're focusing just on the water and they're not worrying about what's around them. I would think those would be the worst warriors. Those would be the ones you'd say, okay, you know, go back to ROTC or whatever, you know, get out. Yeah. But they're the ones that he said, no, they're the ones I want. The 300 maybe of the, you know, it kind of reminded me of a movie I saw about the situation in 1948. You know, the Israeli army, as you know, it was quite outnumbered, and they were trying to build a road into Jerusalem. And in the movie, a Scottish engineer says to the Israeli commander, he says, to use the colorful vernacular, local vernacular, you'd have to be a schnook to want to build a highway up into those mountains. So the commander says to him, yes, we're going to do it. The army of the schnooks, you know. And that's kind of what you have here. The army of the schnooks. You have 300 people, you know, who drank like dogs. They're the ones that he uses. Now you are hearing the sound of a baby. If you're picking it up, I don't know if you are or not. That's not the amen corner. That's the sound of the grandchild. Okay, so I'm in verse 5. Everyone who laps from the water with his tongue is as a dog laps, you shall set apart by himself. Likewise, everyone who gets down on his knees to drink. And the number of those who lapped, putting their hand to their mouth, was 300 men. But all the rest of the people got down on their knees to drink water. So from these 300, God says, I'm going to deliver you with this small number. Because he wanted the people to understand that this was a divine intervention. It was not just their ability, their power, but it was God's power. Then the Eternal said to Gideon, by the 300 men who lapped, I will save you and deliver the Midianites into your hand. Let all the other people go, every man to his place. Now, the actual way the battle took place, I'll skip over, but let me just say that Gideon used a very brilliant strategy. So perhaps this does show that although he was a man of maybe lacking in boldness, he was a man of wisdom, as we'll see later. He was a man of wisdom. So God did choose a man who was a man of wisdom and character, but it had to improve, which he did. You know, he had to increase his faith, which he did. But Gideon had a plan whereby there was panic in the army. And the army, because it panicked, began to flee and fight, among themselves, the soldiers. So it was a brilliant move, and it caused a small number to be able to defeat a large number. But before this happened, there was still one more sign that was given to Gideon. So let's take a look at that in verse 9. All right, Judges 7:9. It happened on the same night that the Eternal said to him, arise, go down against the camp, for I have delivered it into your hand. But if you are afraid to go down to the camp with Purah, your servant. So he knew who he was dealing with. He was dealing with a very cautious person. You know. So he said, if you're afraid, then take somebody with you. Oh, yeah, all right. And you shall hear what they say, and afterward your hand shall be strengthened to go down against the camp. Then he went down with Purah, his servant. He did take the servant to the outpost of the armed men who were in the camp. Now the Midianites and the Amalekites, all the people of the east, were lying in the valley as numerous as locusts. So he had a major force against him. And their camels were without number as the sand by the seashore in multitude. So it must have really looked scary when you have 300 men and you've got that kind of army against you. Verse 13. And when Gideon had come, there was a man telling a dream to his companion. So he's somehow, you know, where he's not noticed. It's at night, and he's hiding, and he hears these Midianites talking. And one man is talking to his companion. He said, I have had a dream. To my surprise, a loaf of barley bread tumbled into the camp of Midian. You know, the barley harvest had already been earlier. If they're harvesting wheat, the barley harvest comes earlier in the spring. And here a loaf of barley bread tumbled into the camp of Midian. It came to a tent and struck it so that it fell and overturned and the tent collapsed. So this loaf of barley bread became a weapon. So it's kind of like saying these farmers, you don't think are great military men, you know, this force of farmers are going to overcome your great army. Verse 14, then his companion answered and said, this is nothing else but the sword of Gideon, the son of Joash, a man of Israel. Into his hand God has delivered Midian and the whole camp. So when this man heard the dream, he interpreted it to mean, we're going to lose tomorrow. We've had it. So it shows that their morale was not high, even though they had so much power. Their morale was not high. Their morale was very low. They were being demoralized. And so Gideon saw this, and this encouraged him. So God gave him that extra bit of encouragement. In verse 15, and so it was when Gideon heard the telling of the dream and its interpretation that he worshipped. He returned to the camp of Israel and said, arise, for the Eternal has delivered the camp of Midian into your hand. So indeed, we have this great victory. As I said, the psychological warfare is used. A technique is used that causes panic in the Midianite army. They flee. The Israelites pursue. And then finally, as we get towards the end of the battle, we have reinforcements are brought in verse 24. Let's go to verse 24. See, I'm skipping the actual battle. You can go ahead and read it later on. Feel free, you know. All of you have Bibles in your home to go ahead and read it. Verse 24, then Gideon sent messengers throughout all the mountains of Ephraim, saying, come down against the Midianites. So they weren't in on the first battle, but now that the army is fleeing, he wants them involved in pursuing them and getting rid of the leadership there, killing their commanding officers so they don't come back. Come down against the Midianites and seize from them the watering places as far as Beth-barah and the Jordan. Then all the men of Ephraim gathered together and seized the watering places as far as Beth-barah and Jordan. And they captured two princes of the Midianites, Oreb and Zeeb. And you'll see references to these later on in the Bible. They killed Oreb at the rock of Oreb, and Zeeb they killed at the winepress of Zeeb. They pursued Midian and brought the heads of Oreb and Zeeb to Gideon on the other side of the Jordan. So evidently they went as far as the east bank and then came back to the west bank, and or vice versa. But they crossed the Jordan River, and they brought this evidence back to Gideon. We have their commanding officers are dead. You know, here's the evidence. We've got their heads here. So we know that they're gone. They're dead. But, you know, here now we have an interesting problem. If you've seen any movies about World War II, you know how complicated it was when you had different nationalities trying to cooperate together and you have egos involved. You know, I remember in the movie Patton, where Patton and Montgomery had a rivalry, and Eisenhower had to, you know, had to deal with it as he was commanding the armies in World War II, the combined forces. He had to deal with these various egos that were conflicting there. So now you have Gideon in the same situation, and he exercises great wisdom here. Now the men of Ephraim said to him, "Why have you done this to us by not calling us when you went to fight with the Midianites?" And they reprimanded him sharply. You know, you got us in at the end of the battle when they were already retreating. Why didn't you call us? You know, why didn't you give us the glory of being in on your initial victory? Why did you get us involved to kind of, you know, mop up, as it were? And so they felt slighted. If you can imagine that, you know. Now he answered with great wisdom, and this again shows a good trait of his that we can copy. You know, being wise, giving a wise answer. Let's go to Proverbs 15. Proverbs 15. In the beginning of that chapter of Proverbs 15, it says, "A soft answer turns away wrath, but a harsh word stirs up anger." It's easy when somebody lashes out at you for you to immediately, you know, oh yeah, you know, and you want to kind of cross swords with them. But it's better to, you know, to concede. Well, maybe he has a point, and then, you know, answer in such a way that you don't antagonize him further. Try to see see his position, what it is, and then okay, and now go from there. You know, try to convince him without lashing back out at him. You know, the tongue of the wise, it says in verse 2, uses knowledge rightly, but the mouth of fools pours forth foolishness. If you just shoot out your mouth without thinking, you'll just make it worse. You know, so have the right kind of answer. And in Matthew, the 10th chapter, especially if you're, you know, in a minority, you've got to be very careful, you know. And so he told his followers, you're going to be out in the world where people do all kinds of wrong things, and you're trying to maintain proper standards, so you've got to be very careful. In Matthew 10, and verse 16, he tells his apostles, Matthew 10, and he tells his disciples, verse 16, Matthew 10:16, he says, "Behold, I send you as sheep in the midst of wolves." You know, a Christian is an innocent person. You know, he doesn't want to do harm. He doesn't want to be malicious. But unfortunately, there are people out there that are predatory people. You know, unfortunately, when I read the news now, I hear about people that are cheating others out of millions and billions. And, you know, it's really sad. You know, there are predatory people out there. And so he says, "Behold, I send you out as sheep in the midst of wolves." So what does he tell you? "Therefore, be wise as serpents and harmless as doves." So, you know, you want to be careful. You don't want to be the one doing the harm. But if you want to avoid having harm done to you, you got to be wise as a serpent, even though harmless as a dove. You know, you want to be both. So let's go back, and here's what Gideon answered. And he answered quite well. You know, in verse 2, "So he said to them, 'What have I done now in comparison with you?'" You know, don't feel like you missed out on the action. You're the ones that got their commanders, you know. "Is not the gleaning of the grapes of Ephraim better than the vintage of Abiezer? You know, what you did was better than what we did. God has delivered into your hands the princes of Midian, Oreb and Zeeb. And what was I able to do in comparison with you?" Then their anger toward him subsided when he said that. You know, so he was willing to credit them with what they did, you know, and not let his ego get in the way. So he gave them a wise answer. So God had given that small army a victory, and then others had gotten involved. So we see that Israel here is delivered, and Gideon now becomes a hero. Let's go now to chapter 8, towards the end of the chapter. Then the men of Israel said to Gideon, "Rule over us, both you and your son, and your grandson also, for you have delivered us from the hand of Midian." So the people were really impressed, and because they lived in a culture where other peoples around them had kings and dynasties with all the trappings of a court and a palace and all that went with that, they were willing to do the same for Gideon. Gideon understood, though, that that's not the way Israel was to operate. Israel was to look to God, focus on God, rather than on any person. They weren't to have a sort of, you know, personality cult and be ruled by some great tyrant, you know, who they would bow and scrape before. That's not. It kind of reminds me of another verse I wasn't going to turn to, but the timekeeper tells me that I have time to do it. So let's see if I can find it. I think in Matthew. In Matthew 20, okay? Let's go to Matthew 20. I wasn't going to turn here, but as I said, the timekeeper has been very generous with me, and he's giving me enough time to do this. Matthew 20 and verse 25. Matthew 20 and verse 25. Here Christ's apostles are jockeying for position. Who's going to be chief, you know? They were human beings like us. They were great men and became greater men. But they were human beings like us. And as I said, all of us have various flaws to overcome. And they were, in effect, jockeying for a position. So he warned them. He said, really, a leader should take his responsibility or the power that he's given and use it to serve. If you're put in a position of responsibility, look at it as an opportunity to serve other people for their benefit. Don't look at it as an opportunity to build up yourself, but rather to serve other people. You know, so he says, verse 25, "But Jesus called them to himself and said, 'You know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and those who are great exercise authority over them.'" And that's the way it was in the time of the judges. The various tribes, ancient peoples that were among that neighbored the Israelites, they had their kings and their rulers, and they took that to be the natural way of things, you know. And so they willingly submitted to these tyrants, you know. But God says here in verse 26, "Yet it shall not be so among you, but whoever desires to become great among you, let him be your servant. And whoever desires to be first among you, let him be your slave, just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life a ransom for many." So he says that's the attitude a leader should have, a Christian leader should have, wanting to serve rather than, you know, building up himself. And so when they came to Gideon and said, we want you to be king, and no, he didn't want that kind of authority. So if you go back again, if you don't mind going back now to Judges 8, you know, Gideon wanted to rule as a judge, not as a king. He wanted them to focus on God, and he wanted to administer God's law to them as judge, but not as a monarch. And so we go back to Judges 8. And frankly, it's verses like this that influenced our founding fathers. You know, America became a democratic republic rather than a monarchy, partly because of verses such as I'm reading to you here. "But Gideon said to them," this is verse 23 of Judges 8, "I will not rule over you, nor shall my son rule over you. The Eternal shall rule over you." It doesn't mean that there's going to be anarchy. There's a judge. Gideon ruled as a judge, but not as a monarch. "Then Gideon said to them, 'I would like to make a request of you, that each of you would give me the earrings from his plunder,'" for they had gotten earrings because they were Ishmaelites. These people whom they plundered were people who liked to have ornaments, earrings, and some of them were moon worshippers, and they had crescent or a jewelry in the form of a crescent, you know, like the moon. "So they answered, 'We will gladly give them.' And they spread out a garment, and each man threw into it the earrings from his plunder. Now the weight of the gold earrings that he requested was 1,700 shekels of gold, beside the crescent ornaments, pendants, and purple robes, which were on the kings of Midian, and beside the chains that were around their camels' necks. They even had their camels decorated. You know, well, they were people who did plunder others, and so they gathered their plunder, and they decorated themselves, and even their camels that they rode. Well, they took all of this plunder, and perhaps one reason why he wanted them to do this was because these were things that were used often for idolatrous purposes or for very vain purposes, and he wanted to put them to a positive use. He didn't want them to be kept around and maybe corrupt their owners. So he gathered them all together, and it was his intention to build a monument, which would be a symbol of the civil authority that he was going to occupy. A kind of symbol such as, when, for example, you go to Washington, D.C., the Supreme Court has an engraving of the goddess of justice. There's this blind woman with a blindfold, and she's holding a balance, like she's going to be objective, and she's not going to look at you. She'll just listen to the details of the case and make an objective decision. That's a symbol. So he wanted a symbol of his authority. So what he did was he gathered all this gold. And depending on what the shekel how you evaluate a shekel, it would seem to me there are hundreds and hundreds of pounds of gold here, which is quite valuable nowadays. What gold's $1,000 an ounce, I think, so it's quite valuable. But what he was doing with it was making a monument, and what he made was a breast, a vest such as a priest would wear, or a governmental official, a monarch would wear. He made this vest of gold and put it as a symbol of authority. And also as a monument probably to the victory that had been won miraculously, as one would do today, build a monument after a great victory. So he had them gather the gold together, and he built this monument, which was a golden breastplate, or ephod, as it's called in the Bible. Verse 27, then Gideon made it, all of this gold that he gathered together, all this jewelry, he made it into an ephod and set it up in his city, Ophrah. So this is where he was going to be an administrator. And so he wanted this symbol of authority. So when they came there, you know, they would have that symbol of authority also as a monument to what God had done for them. But unfortunately, it became an idol. And they began to treat it in a wrong way. You know, fortunately, nowadays, I've been to the Liberty Bell. A lot of you have. I don't see people wearing the Liberty Bell as a good luck charm to ward off harm or I didn't see people bowing and scraping before the bell when I was there. You know, we can understand the symbol of the Liberty Bell without making it into a superstitious thing. Well, unfortunately, this thing did become an idolatrous thing in Israel. It's sad. So Gideon, in this case, I don't know if he's to be blamed or not, you know. Was he unwise in doing this? In his mind, he was doing it innocently. He probably felt like doing this would make it less likely that they would be corrupted by the gold. But actually, in effect, you know, they turned it into something wrong. But I'm not entirely sure we should blame Gideon. It seems that the people of Israel so often just retrogressed into negative behavior. As soon as one of their great leaders was gone, they would tend to just backtrack like that. So, you know, whether Gideon is to be blamed for this, if he is, we can just say that in this case he lacked wisdom, but none of us are perfect. None of the heroes in the Bible are perfect. And that's why all of us, as I started to say when I started this talk, all of us have to always be growing and working on our flaws, overcoming, because, you know, we're not perfect. And we want to become as good as we can be, knowing that we're never going to be perfect. Then Gideon made it into an ephod and set it up in his city, Ophrah, and all Israel played the harlot with it there. It became a snare to Gideon and to his house. So it's a kind of mark against his family that he did this, and evidently it was left there, and even his, you know, others after him didn't get rid of it either. But, you know, they just let it stay there, and it became a problem, unfortunately. But now we get back to the good news. You know, the good news is that God had intervened, that they now had a righteous judge ruling over them, a man of wisdom, as we see, and a man who now was a bolder man for what God had put him through. So in verse 28, thus Midian was subdued before the children of Israel, so that they lifted their heads no more, and the country was quiet for 40 years in the days of Gideon. And we also remember that he was the one that threw down that altar of Baal, that courageously confronted the sacred cows of his age, you know, the idols of his age, and smashed them. In verse 29, he's called again Jerubbaal. Baal will contend. Then Jerubbaal, the son of Joash, went and dwelt in his own house. Now, one last thought about Gideon, again, to show that he was a man with flaws. He was not perfect. He was not a man that, you know, unlike us. Gideon had 70 sons who were his own offspring, for he had many wives. And his concubine, who was in Shechem, also bore him a son, whose name he called Abimelech. And now Abimelech turned out later on to be a very unfortunate character. Whereas Gideon did not want to become a king, Abimelech did become a king and had a brief and very unfortunate reign. So it's very sad that this happened. And we see that, therefore, Gideon's family life was not what it, you know, what it should have been. The ideal in the Bible is one man, one woman for life. That's the way it is, you know. One man, one woman for life. That's the ideal. And polygamy is not the ideal. And, you know, Gideon was polygamous. And, you know, so that's something to be aware of, you know, that, again, he wasn't in every way an ideal person. He still, however, was a hero and a man of faith. And we should, therefore, follow his good examples and realize that he also had his flaws. But he was an overcomer. He was a man who had been very timid and yet was very courageous in serving God when the time came to liberate his people and to give them justice for 40 years. And in verse 32, now Gideon the son of Joash died at a good old age and was buried in the tomb of Joash's father in Ophrah of the Abiezrites. So he dies, you know, in a positive way, in the sense that he had served 40 years, he'd done a great job, the people were at peace and well served during his administration. And we can remember then him in a positive way as a man not perfect, but a man of faith and a hero and one and an overcomer, one whose example we can follow. I'd like to conclude then by going to the end of the Bible, to the book of Revelation. So the example of Gideon is that here was a man with flaws, and God worked with him, patiently worked with him, as you see, and built in him a courage and a boldness that was potentially there but had not come out. You know, God developed him into a great hero, and he became an overcomer, and he set an example for us. Each of us needs to be overcomers so that we can fulfill our potential and have that relationship with God. As it says in Revelation 3 and verse 21, God says to us, Jesus Christ says to us in Revelation 3:21, to him who overcomes, I will grant to sit with me on my throne, as I also overcame and sat down with my Father on his throne. So if we can follow the positive examples in the Bible of those who did overcome and develop their relationship with God, we can be overcomers, and also we can have an eternal relationship with God. Well, I thank those of you who heard this live and those of you who will hear this later. As I said, I hope to be in communication with our people in Africa soon, and literally to be visiting those who listen to us in Southern California in a very shortly. Thank you again also, all of you who've been contacting us regarding the birth of our own Gideon. Until we are in touch in communication again, all the best to you and yours.